So this year, Tueri and I are going to be focusing on two of the Buddhist lists. One is the five hindrances, the other one is the seven factors of awakening. So starting off with the hindrances, these are the times, anytime you feel a sense of struggle in meditation, struggle in your life, if you look carefully, you often see one of these hindrances operating. If you look even more carefully, you see a couple of them probably operating. And so these are common patterns that arise that we often take as something personal, that something's really wrong with me and my meditation. I have the sense if I'm sitting correctly, if I'm meditating correctly, it's just going to be smooth sailing, you know, like no ripples at all. But yet we all know as we practice, there's these ripples, these forces that go through our mind and our body. Same forces that the Buddha was talking about 2,600 years ago. So to keep that perspective that it's not some personal fault of your own mind and body, it's part of this conditioning of having a human mind. And the seven factors of awakening can be seen as a counterbalance, as a way to work with these factors or these hindrances, and also to, if the hindrances are where we struggle, the seven factors are where we release that struggle. And so this month, I've been focusing on the first hindrance of desire or wanting or craving. Now, this one is kind of a one that we have to tread a little bit carefully with because we have a lot of baggage around the word desire. You know, I shouldn't be desirous. I shouldn't be having desires. There's all this conditioning from our culture, from our kind of the religious overlay that we swim and live in. And so we have a tendency to perhaps go into a denial of our desires, denial or suppression, which is really just a form of aversion, a sense of not liking this. It can quickly turn into a sense of restlessness and worry, and maybe we start to fall asleep because we're denying our desires, and pretty soon we have a multiple hindrance attack, right? Because, you know, these hindrances often do travel in packs. You know, they do operate together. So we're teasing out this one hindrance of desire for this month to focus in on it. But keep in mind that we have to have this big picture over these months of how these operate together. And also seeing how the seven factors come in. And I'll bring some of that into this talk, how the seven factors can be very helpful in working with a hindrance like desire. So with desire, we want to make sure we're not judging the fact that we desire, that we have desires that arise. It's natural of being human, right? We have desires for comfort, for love, for affection, you know, for things that taste good, which feel good. You know, we have this desires of experiences which are pleasant and fulfilling. And this is part of being human. Now, when it becomes a hindrance is when we become dependent upon that pleasure, that desire state being present. It's that dependency. It's how much do we depend upon it for our happiness? It's like the short-term happiness, but this practice is really concerned with our long-term happiness. The happiness that's beyond our circumstances, beyond this situation that's arising right now. Our monastic heritage, this Theravadin tradition that is kind of the roots of our lineage, can often be a nice thing to reflect on. As monastics, they have this vow of basically accepting what is offered to them. You know, they may prefer this kind of a food, but if this is what's offered, that's what they eat. This is the shelter they take. And this training really helps to work with desire, that sense of finding sufficiency in what is present in this moment's experience, what's present in these conditions. It also builds this capacity to start to work with what is present. Instead of trying to fine-tune everything to be just perfect, just the right level of ambient noise, the right temperature, you know, the right environment, the right sound system, we can get really fine-tuned to how we want things to be just perfect. But how many people in this room have a perfect life? And how often can you make things just perfect? You know, you get the bath water just right and it gets cool. So often with desire, there's a sense of relative happiness, this immediate gratification, right? And there's also this sense of absolute happiness. And this is what the teachings of the Buddha point toward, is this absolute happiness that's not dependent upon the situation or circumstances. And there's a short-term happiness of achieving something that we desire, you know, that candy bar or that whatever it might be. We know that that is often very short-lived. And where's there a sense of happiness that's not so short-lived? So it often comes down to the sense of how are we training our mind? How are we training our way of being in the world? If we're seeking immediate gratification, being led through this sense of desire, that's how we're training our experience, training what we focus on, what we pay attention to. If we learn to attune to something that's much longer term in terms of happiness, in terms of fulfillment, that's training us in a different way. Now, usually when desire arises in our minds, in our hearts, in our bodies, we have kind of two ways of default working with them. One is to judge it, to repress it, to ignore it, to white knuckle it, you know, try to have discipline. The other is to follow it, to indulge in it, to engage in it. Now, the judgment part, this is really a quality of aversion. This is when we deny the fact that a craving has arose, a sense of desire has arisen. Perhaps we think we're not supposed to have those kind of desires. We're not supposed to want that kind of a experience, that kind of a whatever it might be. So we tend to suppress it. Now, in that very suppression, that very denial, we're cutting off an aspect of our liveliness, our expression of our humanity. If something arises and we deny it, it's in fact there's a violence in that very act. When we don't allow something of ourselves to have its voice. Having its voice is very different than following that. And that's something you start to learn as your practice matures and deepens, that a true refuge is being willing to see all aspects of this mind and body. All aspects of this heart, the parts that we think we're proud about, or we think are worth, you know, having, and the ones that we judge that we're so ashamed of that we hide deep underneath, you know, our subconscious. Right, so our quality of mind is able to see this whole array. We sometimes think if we have that whole array, then we're going to be acting from these painful, destructive patterns. But actually seeing it clearly means it doesn't drive us. It's not being suppressed, not being building up the sense of pressure. So having something arise, we see it, then we have the choice of whether we act from that impulse. That's really one of the gifts of mindfulness, to see and have the space, the pause of choosing whether to act on this, to follow this impulse. But learning to actually see that impulse arise without that judgment allows your heart to really come into its whole, its wholeness. Anything less than that, there's a separation, a place that you're carving out what is inside myself that's acceptable and what isn't. That simple mechanism that we often learn as children, you know, our parents say, this is acceptable behavior, this is not. You know, boys, I remember my daughter and she had a friend's brother fell and was crying, and his father came over and said, you know, don't cry, don't cry. And it was just heartbreaking to hear that message being imparted to this young boy, you know, that boys don't cry. And there's, of course, the whole message is sent to girls. And then if you're, you know, the gender fluidity, you know, where are you in that gender spectrum? There's a whole lot of messages which can be very damaging, very confusing. So as we learn to clean that up in ourselves, then we naturally start to clean it out in someone else, in our other relationships. You know, often parents ask me, you know, how do you bring practice into your parenting? And really the true answer is you bring it into your own heart to such an extent it naturally comes out in that relationship. Same thing, how do you bring it out in relationships, in work, in any interaction? Is you learn to really clear up your internal relationship. You know, perhaps this is what Jesus meant by what's within us that we don't bring forth will destroy us. What is within us that we bring forth will save us. There's that sense of complete honesty with what is in this mind and body. Trusting the discernment will know what's worth acting from, adding more energy to. So judgment, aversion, it's not so helpful with desire when it arises. It doesn't ever go away. You know, it just kind of has this maybe set aside for a while, then it builds this pressure. Now the other side of it, our normal way of acting with desire is to act from it, to actually engage with it, to follow that line. This is really what our whole economy is based on. Right? You know, look at this new thing. You need this to be happy. The messages, the marketing messages are so trained to find what is really your sense of lack, and my product will fix that lack. You know, so there's this commercial economic piece that is as we swim in. Now we act from desire, we act from a sense of wanting. It also has this quality of conditioning the mind. And we got a dog a few years ago, an Australian cattle dog, corgi mix, very cute. And so we tried to work with training him. And learning about that, it's like any behavior that this dog does that has benefit, it is reinforced. And so we try to be really careful about what behaviors he experiences. You know, not getting into the trash, because then there's this reward from that trash. And trying to train him to go this other way. That's more helpful behaviors. Now, we have that shared instinctual aspect in our minds, that our minds, we react to what has benefit. You know, we've paid more attention to that. So, of course, in our society, I mean, think about anything that you want, and how far away is that, really? You know, with Amazon, with you know, you can have any object of your desire, almost every object, in 2 days. You know, if you wanted to name one type of food that you wanted to eat in a place like Seattle, you could find a restaurant to have that. You can have all kinds of experiences, illicit and legal. All these qualities are very accessible. We're kind of in this realm of instant gratification. I'm assuming that we have the means to follow that, which many of us don't. So when we practice meditation, it's really important to notice how do we respond to craving, to wanting, to desire. I mean, how often have you been sitting and you had this impulse to get up and maybe check your phone? Or do, you know, get up and check the refrigerator, or you know, do something else other than sitting still. Right? When we act from that, the mind realizes, oh, this is a way to get you off your cushion. Like, if I just throw this up, they're stopped meditating. Okay, so there's kind of this pressure in ourselves not to be conscious, not to see what's present. And if we act from it, it knows, okay, I just have to throw that up. So having that sense of fortitude, that sense of, okay, I'm sitting this course, you know, I'm not going to get up, even though my mind has this urgency to, you know, check the refrigerator, to check the news, or check the text that just came in. But have that sense of staying on target. That trains the mind to have that diligence, that steadfastness. And walking meditation, we're teaching that last night at the beginning class, and often when you're walking, there's so many interesting things around, right? There's things to read on the bulletin board, there's all these interesting people walking around, you know, you're kind of comparing yourself, I'm walking slower than that person, or that person's, you know, there's all this stuff that goes on. And learning to keep coming back to just feeling your feet, that in itself is this training, the sense of training, guarding our sense doors, so we stay really on focus. So one thing that hindrances, it's maybe hard to see this I didn't really start to notice it until I started to teach retreats, you know, about 5 years ago, that people would come into an interview and be complaining about one of the hindrances, aversion or craving, sleepiness, restlessness. And if I was able to see them a few days later, they often had a deep sense of peace that had come in after that hindrance had arisen, and vice versa. Sometimes when people would be like, you know, I feel so calm, so still. A few days later, a hindrance would be something that would be very predominant in their experience. So the hindrances have this act of kind of breaking or slowing down our practice. It's like we start to really deepen and a hindrance arises. Our mistake is to think something's wrong with my practice. Something's wrong with me. But actually the practice is working well when hindrances start to arise. That means you're actually deepening. So try to reframe that next time you're falling asleep or you're having this sense of restlessness that's coming up. Like, what's wrong now? I was calm in the morning meditation. It's really the practice is deepening and the hindrances are arising as a way of obscuring. If we're able to work with them and be still with them, there's a deeper stillness that comes after that, a deeper insight that arises with that. So usually our two modes are to either repress, deny hindrance, or something like craving, desire, or going into indulging in it, following it. But there's actually a third way to work with it. This is what we talked about last week for the discussion. And that is to recognize that when a hindrance is, when desire is arising, there's often a deeper lack, a deeper sense of insufficiency that the hindrance is trying to solve. And learning to recognize that, actually the most sensible thing, the most wise thing, is to meet the hindrance with compassion. To meet it with compassion. Not with your judgment, not with your repression, not with your indulging in it, but with a sense of compassion. And compassion, we can think of it as these two aspects. This one aspect is that the willingness to sit next to be close to this experience, often something that's painful, to get to know it, to welcome it, to be in proximity to it, so you can start to feel it, sense it, experience it. The second part of compassion is to ask it what is needed. What is needed? So you're touching something that's painful. There's that sense of being willing to be next to it and holding this question, what is needed? What does this pain need? What does this suffering need? Often when you're at that level of it, the object of desire, you can see this has nothing to do with this deeper pain. This is what we explored in the talk 2 weeks ago. So in this way, desire has this paradoxical wisdom, expression of wisdom. What I mean by that is the sense of lack, of insufficiency, that so much is a driving of our life. You know, the sense of me being insufficient, my life being insufficient. I need something to fulfill that, to fix that sense of lack, of inadequacy. It might be a new toy. It might be a new relationship, a new job, a new role. You know, there's this sense of feeling that lack. But if you look at that lack at a very core level, it's inherent from this view of separation. We have this view of separation of self and other, of isolation. Of course, there's a lack. It's inherent in that view. So that's why desire is trying to go back and solve that. It's trying to fix that. But it's not. It often misses the fact that the fundamental view, the fundamental stance is off. This is what I wrote about in the newsletter for the beginning of this year. How the wrong view of isolation, separation, creates this whole sense of kind of a dysfunctional eightfold path that arises based on that assumption. This is where the hindrance arises. It makes sense to seek desirous things when that sense of lack is there. But when our view becomes wise, becomes right view, and we see there's not a sense of separation, there's not a sense of isolation, then desire has much less purchase. There's not much less of a thing of lack that has to be fulfilled. The trick is we can't do that intellectually. We can play with it, we can work with it, we can kind of explore it. But ultimately, it's the insight into that lack of separation which is needed. Otherwise, we're kind of faking it till we make it. You know, and it doesn't quite have the same falling away, the same power of that. Still helpful, but it's that when the insight arises, then there's a clarity that comes with it. So the, I don't know if you say the tragic, but the sad part of this whole thing is that we're trying to solve that sense of lack that's inherent in our view through the external world. External conditions, external situations. If I had that better living environment, that better relationship, that better fill in the blank. Or maybe we internalize it. If I was in better shape, if I was more kind or more, you know, whatever it might be, then I'll be happy. So we're trying to solve this deep lack through changing the circumstances, changing the conditions internally or externally. The sad part is that it doesn't work for the long term. If you just reflect on things that you've really wanted and desired, and there's a sense, okay, once I have that, then I've got it made. You know, then I'll be happy. You know, it doesn't have that same lasting happiness that our heart really desires. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying we shouldn't follow those, try to make our life more fulfilling, more productive, aligning our work and our relationships in a way that's very fulfilling. But just to realize that the relationship itself, the objects of life, are subject to impermanence. They're subject to this arising and passing away. Placing our happiness on something that's going to arise and pass away will cause distress, will cause suffering. In the Buddhist time, before he became awakened, before he became the Buddha means the awakened one, he was reflecting on kind of this predicament of his life. That here he was someone who was, he noticed how his own mind, his own heart, his whole, you know, his emotional state was always in flux. It was always changing, just like ours are. And he realized, here is something who's always changing. This being is always in flux, always changing. Trying to find happiness in an external world which is also always changing and always in flux. So you're trying to solve two variables, and you can't solve the formula with two variables. You have to have a constant in there. And when you realize that, it brings a sense of kind of disenchantment with the voices of desire, this willingness to see what is beyond change, what is beyond change that unites all beings, all things. So last talk, I focused a lot on this sense of this inner lack that often is driving our desire. We're trying to fulfill that. Another way to work with desire is to actually notice what is not lacking in this moment. What is actually sufficient, that doesn't have to be changed, that is perfect just as it is in this moment. This is kind of a funny thing about, we've talked about concentration last year with one of the Eightfold Path, you know, the factor of concentration, how we gather our attention, really have the sense of one-pointedness. Now, there's this kind of dysfunctional shadow side of concentration that's more obsession. More like you're just obsessed with an idea, obsessed with something that you want, that you need to have. Same quality with aversion when we go into that next month, is that there's a sense of not wanting something. There's a sense of contraction around this object. Everything else seems to fall away because we're so focused on it. Internal experience is very different, though, when it's concentration based on the practice, because there's a calmness, there's a steadiness. There's a sense of collectedness. When we really focus on something that's outside of ourselves, there's more of a sense of internal agitation. There's a sense of being at ease, a sense of inner turmoil. You know, the mind is kind of always obsessed. It feels tight. It doesn't feel very nourishing. This is a quality that we all know. And what happens when we focus in this one thing, we forget about the rest of the moment's experience. And just right now, where you're sitting, wherever you are, notice how many different aspects of this moment there really is. There is your breath. There is your body. There's a contact of your body on the chair, the contact of the air on your skin. There's the sounds inside the room, outside the room, inside and outside of the room. There's a sense of the other people in this area and what they are doing or not doing. And we can expand more and more to see all these other aspects. And how many of those things are okay just how they are? That there doesn't have to be anything to change or to fix or to alter in this moment. When we get caught in desire and aversion, we narrow down to just that one object. The absence of what I desire, that's the problem. And I forget about the sufficiency that's present right here, right now. Often when we have a sense of insight into non-self and the absence of self, there's this quality of deep sufficiency in the moment. There's not a sense of me needing anything else. Conversely, when the sense of me is present, that's what's operating, everything is based in lack. Something, you know, there's always something that needs to happen. I need to change something just a little bit. Even when we become very quiet in meditation, there's still a sense of I'm watching my breath, or I'm watching the stillness, I'm watching awareness, and there's a sense of a little bit of doing something with. Now, when the sense of self is seeing, you see through that, either for a few moments or for a longer period, there's often this sense of there's nothing that needs to happen because the linchpin of the self, the separate self, has fallen away. And so there's not this need to come back in, to add something to the moment. So we can start to get a taste of that. We can practice with that by noticing when something's arising that's difficult, that we're struggling with, when a hindrance is operating. I want this. The absence of this is what is the problem. The presence of this is the problem for aversion. Notice what is right in the moment, what needs nothing to be done with. And let your attention rest there. So this is, you can hear, you can feel the sense of stillness arising in the room as you shift into that. Because so often our problems, maybe all our problems are really problems because of the way we were thinking about that. We go into what's right in the moment, our thoughts quiet down and fall away. Interestingly, the same process can be very helpful with someone who's working with trauma history, because the trauma history has a way of making everything really narrow down, get really tight around a particular experience and memory. Noticing what's right in the moment allows us physiologically to start to quiet, to find a place of steadiness. It can be helpful to imagine that the base reality is that of interconnection, of unity, and that we've just forgotten that. And we're trying to remember that. We're trying to reclaim that or rediscover that, as opposed to the base reality being that of separation, of isolation. Because when that's our base reality, that's the whole set of problems are lined up based on that reality. So it becomes no longer about this particular moment's content. It's what's holding all of content, all of experience. So desire, You can see how desire, this hindrance we often think of as this kind of beginner problem, is much more than that. It's really a gateway into some of the deepest dharma, if you follow that. It shows you the deepest sense of lack. And underneath, when that falls away, the deepest sufficiency, the deepest completion, completeness of this moment. I'd like to just finish the evening's talk with going through some of these questions that I wrote out for you on the homework. And this is a process of bringing this seven factor of investigation and mindfulness into something like desire. So when desire arises in your life, on the cushion, in interactions, whatever it might be, often something that's really gripping, that's hard to just, you know, naturally pay attention to, and it falls away. Something has some bite to it, some stickiness to it. These questions can be helpful. First one is to ask, what am I wanting? What am I wanting? Because sometimes it's kind of this vague sense, right? I just want something other than what's here. You know, and so being very clear about that. You know, sometimes I like to go to like a thrift store just because I'm looking for something to want. I don't have anything I'm particularly looking for, but there's just kind of that want, you know. But to be really clear about what is it exactly I'm wanting? Is it that relationship, that person, that experience, you know, that sense pleasure, whatever it might be, really being crystal clear about what that is. Sometimes this in itself starts to sober us up, because we kind of put, you know, what we're wanting in this kind of halo of, you know, how the picture, there's a period where pictures, I think from the 50s, you know, the starlet would have this kind of haze around her, you know, this golden glow kind of a thing. You know, we kind of clear that up so we see directly what it is that we want. And then you can ask, what does that object of want represent? Okay, so we're switching from the object itself to what is it representing? Okay, because if you notice how you plug different things in for the same deep want, you know, at one point it might be a food, and another might be a relationship, or it might be this or that. But there's this commonality, this common denominator. We want to see what that is. Is it a sense of connection, of love, fame, maybe being important? Maybe a sense of safety, of security. Maybe it's comfort, luxury, pleasure. So again, remember at the beginning I talked about that quality of mindfulness which doesn't care what's in your mind. It doesn't judge those dark, hidden parts, those lusts, those rages, all those qualities that we would rather not be there, those arrogances. It's like it's willing to see that, because it knows seeing it is the path through it. Denying it just signs us up for more suffering. So what does that object of want represent? And then asking, what do I hope that will fulfill in me? This is going from the object to what it represents, to what's the deeper lack, the sense of insufficiency? What am I hoping this will fulfill in me? And this can be a very sobering process. I remember feeling a sense of attraction toward a person and say, okay, I'm not going to follow that attraction, but to actually feel it, you know, feel the sense of wanting and asking these similar questions. What is this represent? What's the hope that I have for this? And then as I did ask those questions, there's surprisingly this sense of tenderness, this tenderness of wanting, of loneliness, of not being loved that's arising. And seeing that, I'm just trying to fill that. And here's this person, and next week could be this other thing, and it's a whole range of it. But that common lack, if I learn to focus on that and actually really get to know it, then a lot of my activity in life starts to fall away. A lot of the need to do starts to fall away. You remember what I said about the sense of self? When the sense of self is engaged, a life is full of things to do, things to fix, things to alter, to improve. So this is a process of trying to unhook that deeper pattern. It can be fun with this one. What do I hope it will fulfill? Is there any unrealistic aspects of that? It's like, okay, if I can, sometimes my mind says, okay, if I just get that one new toy or that one new book or object, then I will be happy forever. That would be the last thing I'll ever want. Sometimes I use that argument on my wife, but she does not buy that. My goodness. You know, does our past experiences make that hope questionable? You know, learn from your past experiences, the things that you've really wanted, that say, okay, once I get there, I'll be happy. Reflect on that and say, is this in any way similar to that? Is there any chance that this pattern will be different this time? And coming into this somatic experience, the somatic expression of it, what does this sense of desire feel like as a mind state? That's this title for this year is Mind States, I think. And so desire has a way of coloring and shaping our mind. Our mind forms around the sense of wanting. Right? So we have to learn to release the object of the want in order to see that. If we focus on the object of want, we won't be able to sense what the shape, the generic shape of desire is in our mind and in our bodies. What does it feel like as a body experience? The tightness, the lack, the sense of stance in the mind. There's this beautiful sutta from the Buddha when he described the different hindrances in terms of a bowl of water. You see, you have a bowl of water, and if it's completely clear, you see a clear reflection of yourself. So when we practice, we have a clear sense of seeing, there's no distortion in what's being seen. When craving, when desire is present, that bowl of water has dye poured into it. So it's colored by that particular dye. It has a way of distorting what is being seen in a fundamental way. I think in that same sutra, maybe a different one, the Buddha also has these beautiful analogies of what happens when we're free of the hindrance, when the hindrance falls away. And with craving, with desire, his analogy was, it's like being free of debt. Being free of debt. You know, if you've ever been in a sense of debt and you're able to release that debt, pay it off, there's a sense of lightness that comes from that, a sense of being unburdened, a sense of potentiality from that. You know, that, I remember, anyway, that's a sight, I won't go that way for a second. But that sense of being free, when we release desire and desire releases us, is a better way to say it, there's that sense of being unburdened. In this way of we're so beholding to that object of desire. Another question is, how am I fueling that fire of desire? How am I fueling that fire of desire? That sounds like a song or something. You know, often we find patterns of mind that we have objects that we desire, and we tend to fuel that. We find situations where there's things we want. You know, maybe it's attractive people, and we go to a situation where we're scoping out people and seeing, who am I attracted to? And we tend to focus on that. Or perhaps going, you know, window shopping and that sense of looking for things that we want. Me going to a thrift store, looking for something to want. There's this beautiful phrase called guarding your sense gates. Guarding your sense gates. And so it's like choosing to how the mind wants to go toward what's pleasant and that willingness to say, okay, I'm going to actually stay right here, right in front. Watching that it's not coming from repression or from denial. You know, there's this complete meeting the quality of desire, but not acting from it, not indulging with it. And this can be a fun edge to play with, to notice your patterns, your habitual patterns of desire. You know, where your eyes go, that's often where your desire is. It's, you know, going to a potluck and you notice the dessert and you keep kind of looking at the, you kind of like, it's hard to like stop yourself from looking at that. Play with that. See, what's it like if I don't look? And then the last two, what is the lack? What is the suffering that the desire is trying to fix? So see how we're going from the object to the experience of desire, asking more clear questions and seeing what is the deeper lack that it's trying to fill. You may find that there's several different lacks. There's a superficial lack, and there's a deeper one, and then a much deeper one, down to a very existential level of lack. And you can start to sense that, to feel that. And there can be a sense of compassion for that. Can I be willing to stand next to really connect with it? And to ask, what is needed? What does this sense of lack truly need? And you see the object does not feed that, does not fulfill that. And then finally, what is sufficient about this moment? What is perfect about this moment? Not about the past and all our failings, all our regrets, all our wonderful times. What, not about the future and our hopes and our fears, but right now, in this middle of this moment, what is sufficient? What does not need to be changed? And learning to abide there, to rest your attention there, is transformational. All right, thank you for your kind attention. Let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. This moment, what does not have to be changed? As we abide and rest, relax into that, it starts to spread to all moments of this, all aspects of this moment. We're uncovering what's already there, the perfection that's inherent in each moment. All right, so we have a chance for any comments or questions. And I think usually I talk about the homework, but I kind of just did that. So hopefully that will suffice. Yes, Valerie. Yes. So the follow-up question is around that sense of separation that makes desire difficult to work with. So I would say it's not so much what makes desire difficult, but it's more kind of the underpinning of what desire is trying to fix. There's a sense of it's like if imagine for a moment that there's that sense of deep completion, that there's nothing that needs to shift in this moment. You know, there's like this moment has a complete sufficiency. If we connect with that, where's their desire? Okay. But when we're not connected with that, when we're connected with a sense of insufficiency, of separation, of conflict, of difficulty, you know, that part of that piece, and there's real life conflicts that happen, not to be magically thinking about this, but just the sense of separation of me versus you, the sense of me versus my experience, me versus part of me. I have this impulse and I don't want that impulse. So I got this conflict, this struggle with myself. When that's there, there's an inherent insufficiency there, a lack there. Now often that's kind of a very core underlying thing. Can I build it up into this kind of consciousness level? Oh, I need that experience. Somehow there's a sense that something's not quite right in the moment. Something's not quite okay. And what can I do to make that okay? Well, maybe that pie, or that, you know, going on a trip or going on doing this or that, that will make me feel better. Okay, so we have this sense that things aren't quite right. And so what I need is something I don't have to make that right. Right? So that's kind of that sense of it. That's why it's tricky to work with desire, because we don't often see that deeper connection. And we're trying to, the logic of it is, I'm not happy because something's absent from my life. Something's absent from my mouth, or whatever it might be. There's this sense of not there-ness. Right? But really, if we follow it down, there's that much deeper quality. You know, again, we don't want to get too idealistic with our projection of what that looks like and what that means. I mean, look at the Buddha. We think, okay, he must have, you know, had no desires at all, you know. But, you know, he had preferences. You know, he would much rather not have an aching back and not have dysteria. You know, there's preferences that we have. It's just how caught do we get in those preferences? Does that help? Yeah, good. It's a different kind of silence. Yes?
Could you talk about the role of thought in desire?
So talking about the role of thought in desire. So I would say that it's really a critical aspect of desire. It's almost dependent upon it. You know, there's a kind of an instinctual, you know, movement toward pleasant and away from unpleasant that's, you know, preceding thought or below the level of thought. But most of our lives, you know, it's the process of thinking, of projection, of idea that drives our desire. You know, think about how many things that you've really desired, and there's this kind of idea that you've built up in it. And once you get that object, it doesn't have the same fruition that the mind said. You know, think about the Christmas story and the Red Ryder BB gun, and how he had this whole image of what that will be like, and he gets it and he almost shoots his eye out almost. You know, the reality is often not the same as the image of that. And so thought is what makes that whole thing tick. You know, so thought arises, this is really the sense of lack arises, the sense of thought arises around that lack. Oh, I think what I need is this. And the sense of self then says, okay, let's do that. And there's this whole kind of generation of thinking and selfing that's all driven by desire, by wanting. Yeah, so, and that's one of the big advantages of working with meditation, is we start to become a little bit more discerning about which thoughts we believe in. And we start to realize that, you know, this mind thinks a lot of strange things. And so maybe this thought that I think is really true and valid, maybe that's also a little strange. And eventually we start to see that thought itself is just somewhat of a pointing towards something. It's not the essence of it. It's not the essence of what it points toward. So then we become even more sober around thought. And we realize that sense of opinionation, a sense of this is what the way things should be. And desire can form very strongly around that, can't it? You know, it's like, okay, I really need this. I really want this. And there's just all the reasons for it. We used to say, well, if we take the belief and thought away from it, the whole thing starts to fall away. Yeah, so it's very critical to this whole process. It's hard to talk about desire as a hindrance when people haven't started to have insight into the nature of thought. When thought is still thought as being true and something worth believing in, and of substance itself, it's hard to argue with that, because they say, well, I think it, so it's, okay. It's like. Yes.
I have an ambition to learn more about X. I want to pursue an interest in Y. And I can sometimes say that in the form of a
Yes.
But I don't sense that it's drawn from the same pool of wanting or lacking
mm-hmm.
as
yeah.
The desire that we've been mainly talking about tonight.
Right. So the question is around the interface between desire and ambition is the word you used. And I might even tweak that a little bit to say passion or interest, abiding interest. Because ambition, you know, with any language, we have to kind of make sure we're talking about the same thing. And ambition, you know, what it elicits to me is a sense of, I need to be something else. I have the ambition to be this and to get that. And I think you're talking more about that sense of, you know, deep curiosity or that kind of the heart yearning to engage and to, you know, whether it's learning an instrument or an art form or just, you know, discovery. Is that, yeah. And how is that different from desire? So it's a very important question because sometimes we get the sense that we're not supposed to want anything. You know, we're not supposed to enjoy life. That life is something that, you know, is desire, any form is not, any sense of movement toward is not helpful. And that's not the case at all. So some of the hallmarks, I think I talked about this the last talk a little bit, that when we want, the sense of desire has a quality of demanding and kind of it needs a particular outcome to look a certain way. You know, so there's kind of a contraction quality to it. It's like, okay, I really need this to be a certain way, to look this way, to have this relationship, or whatever it might be. There's that tightness around it. And if that doesn't happen, there's a lot of suffering that comes from that. Okay, because our sense of completion is dependent upon that being a certain way. Now, when there's a different quality, the sense of interest, of passion, of abiding interest, there's much more of this open-ended quality. It's like it's really one of exploration, of exploring and learning and growing and changing. And you're not feeling so solid in it, so locked in it. Like, okay, once I get to that place, then I'll be this kind of a person. That's not the big, you know, I remember in high school, I was a swimmer, but I wanted to be a good swimmer. So I kept thinking, if I get to this time, then I'll be happy. You know, I didn't know what I thought I was going to be, but I didn't get there and I wasn't happy. I think even if I did, I wouldn't have been happy. But there's this idea that I hold so strongly. Well, other things, when I'm really passionate about, when I'm curious about, there's this sense of selflessness that comes from that. That sense of simply being, you know, surrendering to the exploration of it. And often in that process, you're kind of actually willing to set aside your normal constructs about how you take yourself to be. Because how can you learn something that you already know? And if you already have the answer, you're not really learning. You're not really interested. But if you say, okay, I don't know. I want to really engage in this. I want to be curious about it. You have to set aside all that you know to open to it. So it has a different quality, a different sense, a sense of being really enlivened with it. And this is what the Buddha started off with, that deep passion for understanding what is suffering. You know, what's the end of that suffering? And as he taught, coming from that deep passion. So it's not the sense of being bland or having no energy or no liveliness. You know, some of the most awakened beings have a great deal of aliveness and great deal of passion. But there's also this way that they hold it very lightly. It's like there's a sense of, okay, there's this passion, but they're not held to how it manifests, how it shows up. And it's a good koan. It's a good, you know, life puzzle, a riddle, a Zen riddle to explore. It's like, when do I start to go in to desire that contraction? And when do I go into this more pure, you know, curiosity? And for most people, it's a little mixed. You know, so it's kind of the ratio. Is it mostly desire and contraction, trying to, you know, feel better about myself, or is it mostly that sense of exploration? And often, you know, you see that in someone who's a master, their trajectory is they started off maybe with that sense of insufficiency, you know, they were trying to solve something. But as you start to get more and more into it, then there's this way it really evolves. There's this creativity that happens. Not always. Sometimes there's, you know, things fall apart and they get really tight around it. Yeah. Now, if you don't have the passion for practice, we won't progress, to use that forbidden word, on the path. It's like that it takes a tremendous amount of energy and interest and passion to go through the waves of delusion, of greed, of contraction that we all live with. And so that passion, that really that deep passion, is needed on the practice. And it can be for many things. Rodney used to say that, talking about right livelihood, sometimes people focus so much on what that looks like. And his instruction was often, what brings you alive? That's right livelihood. What gets you engaged? Because then you're fully alive. All right, what else is out there? Yes. So is aversion to the present, I think I'm cutting out a little bit, is aversion to the present a necessary aspect of desire? Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. So at the beginning I was talking a little bit how we're kind of taking apart these hindrances in one at a time, but really they're often operating together. Like I was reflecting, I like to walk around the building a little bit before I talk, and just feeling, okay, primarily there's a sense of aversion that's operating, but then there's craving that kind of comes from, you know, out of that, or a sense of desire. Often there's pain that we're averse to, and then we go into craving because we, you know, we want something pleasant. And so often they can work together in tandem, or kind of going together in a sense of kind of interrelated. So that's often the case, that these hindrances kind of run in packs. And, you know, our minds can get agitated and restless around it, and that's another hindrance. Or maybe we start to getting exhausted and tired, or we're doubting it. So we kind of have all these hindrances kind of swirling around. So that can be some of the challenging times of practice. I think there can be, though, kind of a more pure manifestation of it also, that there's just, okay, I'm really focused on what I want, what I'm moving toward, versus what I'm moving away. And sometimes you can ask yourself, am I moving more toward something, or more moving away from something? Because often we move away from something that's painful towards something that's pleasant. You know? And so then in that case, we are moving from aversion is present. But it doesn't always have to be there. Often it is. And some of us, many of us have, you know, certain defaults, kind of our go-to hindrance. You know, there's the kind of a classic thing. You come into a room and some of us notice what's nice in the room, what we find attractive. And other of us go in and find what we don't like in the room. You know, this is kind of our almost a, what do they call it, constitutional conditioning that tends to bias our general attention. And so we just start to notice that, oh, I tend to always notice what's not right in the room. I always notice what's good in the room. Both of those have a quality of delusion, right? We're not seeing the whole picture. So yeah, just notice for yourself. Again, it's the invitation is always to come and see for yourself. You know, cravings arising. Okay, is there a sense of discomfort or something I'm moving away from? Yeah. Well, maybe part of your question is when I'm talking about lack, is that what's driving it? Yeah. Yeah, maybe it is with all of them. Yeah, maybe there is that sense of lack that the way I was talking about it, I can see why you asked that question now. I have to think about that. Yeah, explore that a little bit. All right, any last questions? Scanning to the left, scanning to the right. All right, thank you for your engagement. And you know, the questions really help to kind of flesh out the topic and make it really alive for you.